talking about now, to some degree, is really kind of a combination of what could be treated as two very different topics, or even three different topics. One issue being the issue of scholarship, biblical scholarship, scholarship of the period of Chazal, and the other having to do with a cook. So it's a combination of things that a real academic institution nobody would ever talk about because two different disciplines. But I'll do what I can do here, and I think that there's at least a minimal value in trying to put these two things together. First issue is the question of Mashiach ben Yosef. Most people by now have heard about Mashiach ben Yosef. I go around the room and ask people when they first hear of Mashiach ben Yosef. Interested in answers people give to that, we don't have time to go into it though, so the one person whose answer I will quote here is mine. I first heard Mashiach ben Yosef as a little kid, and I picked up one of these sidurim that has Kabbalah in the middle of a siddur, where you're davening there, and there's a little note saying that here you should have kavana that Mashiach ben Yosef shouldn't die. So what I learned from that is a few things. Number one, that there's a thing called Mashiach ben Yosef. Number two, that there's danger that he would die. Sort of a Mashiach under some kind of shadow, some kind of threat. Number three, that if I'm a good Jew, I don't want him to die, that I would like to pray to prevent his death. That's what I figured out from all of this. The fact that I had not heard Mashiach ben Yosef elsewhere seemed to indicate to me that Mashiach ben Yosef may not necessarily be a household word, even though it does play a role here. I mean, I had certainly known Mashiach ben David a long time before I ever heard Mashiach ben Yosef. Mashiach ben David's father, Tzimut Bacha, those people knew him, knew he was not a great singer, but he did sing Mosei Shabbos, and, Mashiach ben David, so I heard about when I was 2 years old, I was 3 years old, even at such a young age that I was the only person who actually liked my father's singing. Happy to hear his singing now, but that's a little late thing. Anyway, those are the assumptions that I came with as a very small child. Later on, I discovered two very general things about Mashiach ben Yosef from Chazal. One is, that Mashiach ben Yosef either dies or is in danger of dying. That is confirmed. The other is the notion of Mashiach ben Yosef being involved in war, a warrior Mashiach. Again, the two things seem to be connected in some way, because if you go to war, there's a chance you'll die, and if you're going to die, then it's likely that you've been involved in a war. So there seems to be some connection with these two ideas, but those are two ideas that seem to come up in Chazal. Again, once I knew Chazal better, I noted that there's not that much about Mashiach ben Yosef. It doesn't play that large a role. I go a step further and look at the kind of books that very often influence the way we think about Chazal. Rambam. Perek Yud Beit of Hilchot Malachim. The Rambam is talking about some of the things you have in the Pesukim or literal about Mashiach, and some things are figurative, and Rambam says, Yera'em yipshutan shel divrei nevi'im, it would seem from the simple meaning of divrei nevi'im, which usually means that some of the Rambam does not interpret literally, but he's saying he reads the Pesukim literally, shebitchilat mot Mashiach, beginning mot Mashiach, there will be a war of Gog u'Magog, and that before that, Ya'amod Navi li Asher Yisrael Achim Libam Shvarineno Kisholeach Lekam Etel Ya'anavi. There will be a Navi who will reform the people. And his proof for that is a post to Malachi, referring to Eliyahu HaNavi, coming lifnei bo yom Hashem ha-gadol b'hanura. Eliyahu HaNavi will come. But you notice, the Rambam does not say Eliyahu is going to come. The Rambam says, a Navi will come, and his... Then he quotes a pasuk that deals with Eliyahu. Veino ba'al tamei, ha-tahor, l'teher tamei, says something about what this Navi is going to do. Then he goes on, he says, Yesh min ha-chachamim shomrim. There are sages who say that before Yemot HaMashiach, Eliyahu is going to come. He's very careful here to say, even though Malachi says Eliyahu, the Rambam is saying, all I'm committed to is a Navi. And he says, some of Chachamim say that it's that is Eliyahu. And he goes on, famous words, I've quoted many times, saying that speculating about these things too much is not really that important. It doesn't lead to get it to Shem, up at Hashem. Now, what's missing here is Mashiach ben Yosef. The Rambam doesn't say anything at all, but some people hold as Mashiach ben Yosef, and that's for the Rambam. This is clearly not a normative idea. It's not something you're obligated to believe or not to believe. Among medieval Jewish philosophers, Sadi goes into discussion about Mashiach ben Yosef. But I'm not here to give a survey of everybody who ever mentioned the concept or didn't mention the concept. In Chazal, you have those few references that you have. So you have a statement in the Gemara in Sukkah, Daf Nun Beit, that talks about the Yibitu al Asher Dakaru, which the Pasuk will mention later as well. In Zechariah Perek Yud Beit, as the people will look at he whom they have pierced. He whom they have pierced. But go out in the street and ask people, who does that pasuk refer to? They will think about he whom they have pierced, and they will mourn him.
In this neighborhood.
Yeah. Who would they?
Jesus.
Yes.
Ben
yes. The Christian tradition, that verse has been applied to the founder of religion. They will mourn he whom they have crucified, whom they have pierced. If I were Krishna, I would have shot that way also. Seems to fit. The Gemara, however, says there are two possibilities raised in the Gemara. It's already a Tanaitic drasha. I believe it's a Bidosa and Chachamim. And they one view is that this refers to the Yetzer Hara, this famous notion about killing the Yetzer Hara, which I'm not going into right now. The other is that they are mourning Mashiach ben Yosef was killed. That's a very clear source in Chazal that talks of Mashiach ben Yosef. There are other sources in Targum Yonatan or Pseudo Targum Yonatan at the end of Shmot, in Targum and Shir HaShirim, in Midrash Tehillim, not giving you a list. So we have this idea. You could tell me, how does such an idea develop? You could say it develops because there's a difficult pasuk in Yechezkel, in Zechariah. You have to explain who was pierced and so on. Offhand, I don't know how convincing that is, because you could give other pshatim for that pasuk. It's a difficult pasuk, but the fact the pasuk is difficult means it's hard to explain it. It also, in a certain way, means it's easy to explain, because you can say almost anything, and it will not be obviously worse than any other pshat you could develop. But you have that. You could say the pasuk is driving it. You could say some tradition of the Mashiach ben Yosef. If there's a tradition of Mashiach ben Yosef, then what is this notion? We know Mashiach ben David. We know what David is about. You have enough pesukim to deal with it. It's a very fundamental Ikar HaEmuna. But what's this? Where's Mashiach ben Yosef coming from? What is this duality of Mashiach? Here, I want to make an observation I found very helpful. Doesn't so much explain the point as put the point in the correct context. You're coming to this issue with a 20th century Jew and Mashiach ben David and Mashiach ben Yosef. Why do you need two? You're telling me they have different roles. Mashiach ben David is sort of successful Mashiach. Mashiach ben Yosef is a failed Mashiach. Why do you need two? Why do you need such a figure? That turns out to be the wrong question to ask. And the reason that it's the wrong question to ask becomes evident only if you look at the non-rabbinic literature of that period. You look, let's say, in Dead Sea Scrolls, the Serach HaYachad. Was it referred to in English? The Manual of Discipline. What? Serach HaYachad. Yachad means the community. People are together. And Serach would mean the manual. So it's in the among the Dead Sea Scrolls you have it. And they talk there about the Mashiach Aharon v'Yisrael. There are two Mashiachim, one of whom is a Kohen and one of whom is not a Kohen. You look in the Testament 12 Tribes, which is a book in pseudepigrapha, and they'll talk there about priestly messianic figures and a Mashiach from Shevet Yehuda. Normally, when I think about it, and you ask me how important are these books, I'd say it's a question. Well, years ago, 15 years ago, Yissi Blau was teaching a Jewish history course by Cheney History, which was Flatbush, a long, long time ago. He was preparing. He'd never taken a course in the field. He was preparing. And over the summer, every once in a while, he'd be talking to me. At one point, he asked me, he said, it's a simple question. I don't know, it's maybe an obvious question, but everybody spends so much time talking about the Sea Scrolls, the Sea Sects. How many people were involved in this? How important are they really? And nobody seems to talk about that, but it seems to be a fundamental question. And I told them they probably were not very important. The reason that people spend so much time on them is because they represent some kind of alternative to more traditional kinds of Judaism. Some people, for ideological reasons, secular Zionists, they like the idea of some kind of Judaism that's not rabbinic. And some people need to write term papers, so they need something that other people can write term papers on. And some people may just be interested in getting a fuller picture, even if it's a small number of people, and at that report, it gives you a different picture. And this is one case where that third option really becomes important, where I think you really don't understand Chazal from the right perspective until you see what you have in these other sources. Because you learn from the other sources is not just, well, there's a Mashiach Aaron and a Mashiach Yisrael. What you learn is that for people in the Beit Sheni period, be it Chazal or be it the sectarian people, there was no duality of Mashiachim. There was not Mashiach ben David and another Mashiach, not a duality, a plurality. If it's duality, you've got a kasha. If you've got a duality, then that's what do you need to know? Once you've got more than two, the question becomes less problematic. Once there are more than two messianic figures, it just means that if there are several figures associated with Yemot Mashiach, you make a list of those people. And that can be Mashiach ben David, and we all know about. It can be some kind of priestly messianic figure, and certainly are mentions in Tanakh, Gimel, other places, Zecharia, early Prakim Zecharia, of Kohanim who are somehow associated with Yemot HaMashiach. And it could also be Eliyahu. You know, if you wanted to give Eliyahu a fancy name, you'd call him the Messianic Navi. Which Rambam really does. Rambam says there's going to be some prophetic figure associated with Yimot Mashiach. So, you know, and some chachamim call him Eliyahu, you know, use the word Eliyahu and claim he's Eliyahu. And you get a Mashiach ben Yosef. In a certain way, four Mashiachim is less of a mystery than two. It's less problematic than two. And if we didn't have these outside sources, it was much harder to make that jump between duality to plurality. Once you've already made that jump, you could open up a Gemara in Sukkah. So Gemara quoted earlier is Sukkah that Beit Amud Aleph. If I look at Sukkah and Beit Amud Beit, Gemara says, "Vayareini Hashem arba'ach karashim." Zechariah Perek Beit, pasuk about the piercing was Zechariah Yud Beit. This pasuk is Perek Beit early in Zechariah. God showed me the four smiths. Who are these four Chorashim? Amar Abchana Bar Bizna, Amar Bishimon, Chasida, Mashiach Ben Yosef, Mashiach Ben David, Eliyahu, the Kohen Tzedek. If I look at the Gemara in the light of what I just said a moment ago, the Gemara is perfectly clear. The Gemara is saying there are four smiths, there are four horsemen of redemption, as it were. The four horsemen actually starts in Chayei Perek Aleph, but that's, people are laughing and thinking about the in fact, that Roosevelt made this nasty speech about four members of the Supreme Court that had been applied, four horsemen, the pestilence of doom. Let's get back to our business. Who are these four smiths? Mashiach ben David, Mashiach ben Yosef, a priestly figure who's called Kohen Tzedek, and Eliyahu, a prophetic figure. And this gives you a sense of how these ideas developed. You want an article that's very good on this issue. Yosef Heinemann, a professor at Hebrew University, officially using Hebrew literature. I don't want to go and get involved in the politics of Hebrew University in that period. He really was teaching Midrash. Written Tefila and wrote a lot about Agadot and a lot about how Agadot develop. You take generation to generation and how the Agadot takes form. So he has a book called Agadot Toldotihen, and there's a chapter on the Mashiach ben Yosef issue which I recommend. Once you have that background, you can start discussing why would the figure of Mashiach ben Yosef become more prominent or less prominent. And there again, we're back with these questions about the Mashiach who goes to war and the Mashiach who dies. Going back to that. Once you're talking about that, there's one other set of psukim that you should think about, which flow into Chazal. There is a story of the Bnei Ephraim who left Egypt prematurely. In Tanakh, this is found in Divrei HaYamim Aleph Perek Zayin, the genealogical chapters, and it's rather vague. There's something about Bnei Ephraim who are involved in some battle in Eretz Yisrael, apparently before Yitzhak Mitzrayim, and they get killed. In Chazal, you have the notion that these Bnei Ephraim were killed because they left Egypt prematurely. Now that notion, you start to think Bnei Ephraim, heroic figures, bold figures, wanted redemption, they end up getting killed, and they go to war. That can be suggestive of the Mashiach and Yosef notion. And you find the Gemara, Sanhedrin, Sanbeit, Amud Beit, I think. Yeah?
Sukkah
Nun Beit, Amud Aleph, and Amud Beit. And now we're in Sanhedrin, Sanbeit, Amud Beit. Rav, early Babylonian Amoda, who says that these were the dead people that Yechezkel resurrected. So that notion of tragic figures who die, and there's something, some connection being made here as well. Historians have made the connections of a Kafla rebellion, where you have a kind of potential messianic figure who clearly is not really Mashiach because he dies. I don't want to offend anybody who is the Lubavitch, but at the same time, you want to give him some kind of credence. You may want to give him some kind of positive role. But let me move on from here to the second half. The idea of Mashiach ben Yosef again percolates through, as I mentioned to you, Sadibon mentions it. There were certain, I don't call them late midrashim, or I don't know what to call them, books like Sefer Zerubbabel, kind of chronicles or fantasy works that circulated in the early period that also talk about such a figure. It's interesting, there's one midrash I almost forgot about. In Bamidbar Rabba, Parshat Naso, which is people into Midrash is you date B'Midbar Rabba. B'Midbar Rabba, the early Parshiot are very late, the medieval Parshiot. So they're after all the stuff we're talking about previously. And there are four Mashiachim, Mashiach Ben David, Cohen, Jessica Gemara and Sukkah, Mashiach ben Ephraim, which sounds like Mashiach ben Yosef, and Mashiach from Shevet Menashe. My take on this is that the author of this midrash, which was very, very late, had the idea of being four messianic figures, but he no longer had a sense of who exactly these people were. So you had the number four, and in his mind, Eliyahu was something completely different from everything else. Eliyahu was not a messianic figure, Eliyahu was a Navi. So he then split Mashiach ben Ephraim into Ephraim and Menashe. But anyway, you have these sources going through. Certainly Kabbalah got a lot of attention, as I hinted at the very beginning of discussion today. And people know about it. The Rama may not have cared about it, did care about it. We now come to 1904. On the 20th day of Tammuz, Theodor Herzl had a heart attack and died. The age of 44. What are we supposed to say about Herzl? Good guy or bad guy?
Complicated.
From a religious point of view, he's not one of us. I don't know how much people knew, whether his son is circumcised, isn't circumcised, and people in 1904 did not read Stanislavski's book about Herzl 5 years ago, or any of the other literature of Herzl. But he was an assimilated Jew very far. On the other hand, if you are pro-Zionist, then you view him as something of a heroic figure. What do you make of him? How do you deal with this? Now, for simple-minded people, you figure out, you sit down, you listen to whatever people say, and then you either give them thumbs up or thumbs down. If you're a cook, you can't get away with that. So now we have a 39-year-old Rav, newly arrived in Eretz Yisrael. And he's giving a hesped. And the title is called Hamispeid Yerushalayim. And the Herzl is not really the direct topic, but the occasion is very clear. So, look at a few passages here, and that's the way we'll get through and we'll discuss. He starts with the pasuk in Zechariah. Bayom ahu yigdal mispeid Yerushalayim ki mispeid hadad rimon bivikat Megiddo. On that day, the hesped will be like the hesped of Hadad Rimon. Do you know what Hadad Rimon is? Somebody said Yoshiyahu. Is that what the pasuk says? Is that what you? That's what you know from Chazal. Okay, that's one possibility. The other possibility that is raised in Chazal is Achav. Achav. Yes. So you've got Yoshiyahu or Achav, and you realize Yoshiyahu and Achav are two very different kinds of kings. Yoshiyahu, you think of as a very firm king. Think of Yoshiyahu as being as firm as summer days long. You think of Achav, and he's as wicked as winter night is long. Don't think of Achav as a good guy. Now I know, I don't have time to get into it, that the Achav who appears in Chazal have a soft spot for him. Again, I don't have time to go into it, but again, Chazal, you have two possibilities. The misbeid will be like Achav or the misbeid of Yoshiyahu. Where did Chazal get this from? Hadad Rimon, nobody knows what that word, who it's really referring. We don't have anybody with that name. But you have Megiddo, which is a place we do know, and Megiddo is associated with Achav, and it's associated with the death of Yoshiyahu. Yoshiyahu died at Megiddo. So apparently Chazal reached out and they made it to Shayah. Who else? Valley of Megiddo, so they tied it together. Now, the cook then mentions another Ma'amar Chazal, which indicates that there are things in Nevi'im that are mysterious, and it's very bold to explicate them. And including this pasuk, the cook says, well, you know, what is really so mysterious about this pasuk? Why is this? The Targum, Kimispeid Hadad Rimon, that should refer to Achav. Why is that such a, and the Hesped of Yeriyahu, of Yoshiyahu, I'm sorry, why should that be so mysterious? What's so problematic about it? Now, the next step in developing with Russia. If the cook then introduces the Gemara in Sukkah, which says that misbeid will be in Mashiach ben Yosef, which now means, homiletically, that both Achab and Yoshiyahu get tied in to Mashiach ben Yosef. Which now leads to ask, what do we need two figures, both Mashiach ben David and Mashiach ben Yosef? After all, you know, anybody throw me, it's Mashiach ben David. You ask anybody in the street, it's Mashiach ben David. You ask anybody in the street here, they'll also Mashiach ben David, because Oto Ish has Yichus to David on his mother's side. Yeah. So why do we have this plurality here, this duality? Next move that Cook makes is to discuss Yehuda versus Yosef. The duality, Mashiach ben David, Mashiach ben Yosef, is a duality of Yehuda and Yosef. Two leaders among Bnei Yaakov. And the picture that Cook is going to give is that Mashiach ben David, Mashiach ben Yehuda, is the spiritual Mashiach. Mashiach ben Yosef is the more practical Mashiach. Yosef was an economist. Doesn't sound like Professor Levine, but he'll go to the economics dinner tomorrow. I'm sure he'll make that comparison. Yosef is a great economist. But Yosef is involved in practical life. And Mashiach ben David is presented as being involved in spiritual life. If we make the connection now, we think about what Mashiach ben Yosef is about. Number one, Mashiach ben Yosef is a military Mashiach. That corresponds to practical life as opposed to spiritual life. So the splitting of the roles involves making one of those roles more this worldly as opposed to being spiritual. The second point is, Mashiach ben Yosef dies. Meaning that in terms of final redemption, even though the role of Mashiach ben Yosef is important, it is a role that ultimately is eclipsed. I'm at quoting of Cook now, I'm just working out the logic. If you were of Cook and you had proceeded this far, this is what we should expect him to be saying. Now the point then is, as far as Rav Cook sees it, even though there is primacy to Mashiach ben David, there is primacy to Yehuda, and even though in theory the two realms are interconnected, the spiritual and the corporeal are not totally divorced from each other, one connects with the other, despite all of that, there nevertheless is room for a certain kind of specialization at the social level. This is a theme that appears in Cook's writings in many different areas. The notion of plurality. People are different. Social roles are different. And different people are suited to different kinds of social and spiritual functions. An organic sense of how a community works together. And he is now applying that to this specific issue. Ultimately, Mashiach ben Yehuda gets primacy. But in the interim, there is a certain degree of specialization.
Ben Yosef is B'Dera Hatev.
Yosef is a natural order, the which would include the as Pshat from Sukkim, it's a realm of economics, Yosef, if we know. But it's also the warrior element. Now, here, what can get in your way is that you think of David, after all, David fought so many wars, and you know, So, you know, this may be an obstacle to your grasping this. But if you go back to a sense of Yehuda being, of Yosef being involved in physical Yeshua, then you get this duality. You get this plurality. If I just look at the lines that I underlined on the bottom of page 95, Hine gam acharei ha-perud, even after the two kingdoms split, you remember after Death of Shlomo, where there were different political sovereignties here, im hayu al kol panim mit achadim, that each one should go in his individual way. That each side would learn from the other one. Whereas each person has his own role, but you're able to learn from the other one. Yehuda yikabel me'Ephraim v'chim tiyot mokhsharot v'l'shichvul ha'uma. Yehuda would learn from Ephraim the good ways of building up the nation, betokef chomriyuto v'neshuto klalit, in material terms and in human universal terms. Very interesting point. Rav Kook is associating the physical element also with the universal element. With the Jew's duality, you're concerned with Olam Haza, Olam Haba. You are also, as a Jew, concerned with humanity and concerned with the specific sancta of the Jewish people. Both are important. Yosef, who represents this world, represents that element as well. And again, the biblical Yosef is involved in Egyptian politics. Man of the world, speaks seven languages. He's a, you know, the administrators were here. They would probably say that Yosef was a Torah Rara person. Use those slogans, but maybe it wasn't so much. And Ephraim should learn from Yehuda. Those elements that are specifically Jewish in their sanctity. And out of Kook goes on, he discusses the Gemara, Gemara Sanhedrin, about this famous dialogue between God and Yeravam. God said to Yeravam, remember Yeravam was with Shevet, Ephraim. So we have this duality, Yehuda and Ephraim. This Yeravam would be playing out the Ephraim role. And God said to Yeravam, Chazor b'cha, turn back from your divisiveness. Vani v'ata uven Yishai neteil yachad b'Gan Eden. You and I and Ben Yishai will walk together in Gan Eden. And Yeravam then asks, Mi Barosh, who's number one? And Rabban Shem tells him, well, Ben David is number one. And Yeravam says, no, in that case, no. For Rav Kook, that illustrates the point we're making here. You have an orientation which symbolically Ephraim would stand for, this less spiritual orientation. Again, if you're just reading Sefer Melachim, then there's no completely spiritual about Rechavam, other than the fact that Yehuda has a Beit HaMikdash. So when Yeravam breaks away, he's breaking away from Beit HaMikdash. But in terms of personality, there's nothing more spiritual with Rechavam than with Yeravam. But symbolically, and in terms of what these two types of political entities involve, then Yehuda is the spiritual, Yosef is the more physical, and could say more universal. Let's turn to 97, where I did these underlines in order to make it easier for me to finish on time. Come back to that hesped. So the hesped now is a hesped Mashiach ben Yosef. And Mashiach ben Yosef, again, the Targum will say that the hesped is in Yoshiyahu and Achav. And Yoshiyahu is certainly Beit David. Yoshiyahu would certainly assimilate to Mashiach ben David. Very hard to say Yoshiyahu is Mashiach ben Yosef. It's clearly Huda. Achav is the Ephraim figure. Remember, Achav is somebody who, in many respects, you could easily view as a Rasha, even though, as I mentioned, Chazal had a soft spot for him. Chazal seemed to like him. So you come back to Pasuk in Zecharia. V'safdu alav ki mispeid al yachid. That morning will be like a mispeid or yachid, which would mean an only son. V'hamer alav, it will be bitter, the way people are bitter about the loss of a b'chor. Two verbs here, safad and hamer. Safad, you translate eulogize, very reasonable. And hamer means to be bitter. Which is more intellectual, so to speak? Safad or Hamer? Hesped. Now, hesped implies some kind of intellectual performance. Hamer, you're just bitter. So you have Hesped and Hamer, and you have a Ben Yachir and the Bechor. Now, you know, obviously no parent wants to lose any child. But the Pasuk seems to be contrasting the loss of a Ben Yachir and the loss of a b'chor. Look, there's interesting things to say about this terminology. Hamispeid huitrakshut l'sha'ata mimachazeh madiv. Mispeid is a certain kind of emotional response to something painful. Hamachnis kodesh koder v'yeush balev. It is depressing. Like the eulogy for a ben yachid, the severity of the loss of Ben Yachid is that that's your entire world. You have several children, you lose one, your posterity is not destroyed. You lose a Ben Yachid, it's all gone. It's all gone. Horim zkenim ibdu et b'nam yachidam. Old, aged parents, they lost their only son. Merirut is already, the cook says, a more intellectual performance. He's saying the opposite of what I suggested a moment ago. Merirut, to be bitter, involves something more intellectual in his opinion. It evaluates the situation. So when you lose a b'chor, the tragedy is not that your life is over, as if you lost a ben yachid. Losing the b'chor, the cook says, is usually a sign of stupidity on the part of the parents. Again, this is, doesn't really fit today, but, you know, maybe different society. You lost your first son because you're incompetent. You didn't feed him properly, you didn't put him in bed the right way. So there, you lose a b'chor, you have not lost your entire future, because presumably you lose a b'chor, you're still young and you look forward to something. But there is something to be bitter about. This bitterness would imply that you did something wrong. Bitterness implies that there's need for reflection. So you notice Rav Kook did, as opposed to what I suggested, that Hamer has a very strong emotional connection, whereas Hesped is telling a story. Rav Kook is saying that Hesped is simple grief. Bitterness involves, if you want to translate bitterness with one English word, self-accusation, self-recrimination. Now, how does that work in terms of language we use today? You said a person who's bitter would always be a person who is making some kind of moral statement, somebody either towards himself, towards others, a sense of having, not of having lost the future, but of having acted badly in the past. I'm not sure. I mean, think about it. It's, Kena Uma, when the nation looks back at the death of Yoshiyahu and the death of Ahav, you look at that situation, so there's one anxiety, there's one tragedy that has to do with the loss of the future, and there's one anxiety that would have to do with having made mistakes in the past, having missed opportunities in the past. If you go to the next underlining, then according to Chazal, Ahav may have been a wicked idolater, but he was a good Jew. He was good for the people. He was a builder. Lu'umat zeh Yoshiyahu, bottom of the page, higbir et tzad ruchani. Yoshiyahu was associated with the return to Torah. So the tragedies of Ahav and Yoshiyahu bring together both of these points. The point of Yosef, the point of Yehuda. Mashiach ben David, Yosef and Mashiach ben David. The failure to properly integrate the spiritual and the physical, the political. This, the Cook says, the Navi is hinting at. They will look at whom they have pierced. They will look at what they have lost, what they have squandered, and they will be masbid the way we masbid for a ben yachid, who is threat, there's no future anymore, and hamer al kamer al b'chor, you've acted badly, you've lost your initial opportunities. Those are two elements, and that's what the Targum, by naming this victim as Ahav or as Yoshiyahu, is making more explicit. Now, moving on from here, and I will not look at the last page for a lot of time, what the cook is doing without mentioning Herzl by name, he is talking about this phenomenon, and he's not saying anything about Herzl as an individual person. That's even more important in terms of what's happening here. He's not interested in who Herzl was personally. He's not just giving grace. Because what Cook is interested in is Zionism, not Herzl. So the Hesped on Herzl really becomes a Hesped on the potentialities of Zionism. Cook's concern is a larger picture. How are we going to proceed further? And the perception that the great tragedy in the spiritual powers of Jewish people, called Trum world, the rabbinic world, having gone one way, and the political needs being taken care of by people who are not sufficiently sensitive to these issues. If I summarize it that way, it would sound as if here, Rav Kook is doing a lot of huffing and puffing and giving you a very complicated drasha and the conclusions you could get in any newspaper editorial. Well, you know, there's spiritual powers and there are physical powers, we really want to integrate them, we should harmonize them. I think the drasha is not just window dressing. By taking this political point, this spiritual political point, and dressing it up in the language of interpretation of the Gemara and Sukkah, the Gemara and Kut, and all these other sources, Rav Kook is not just putting window dressing on the idea. I think he's also forcing us to rethink the issues, not through the prism of the newspaper editorials of 1904, but through the prism of eternity. In general, when you try to apply Psukim Amrei Chazal to contemporary issues, very often, if you do it in a mechanical way, it's not ishkeit. If you look through for gematziot and the correspondence, this pasuk, that pasuk, and they think they pull some gematria out of the pie and they suck their thumb and they say, you know, boy, am I? They lick their fingers with the sweetness of their cleverness. That is not really drash at the highest level. The drash at the highest level is where your conclusion may appear to be a commonplace conclusion, but you've earned your right to that conclusion because you really have thought through many of the traditional sources. You've asked yourself, why should Acha be so important? Why should Mashiach ben Yosef be so mysterious? Why should the relationship be so tragic? You work it through the Targum, the Gemara, and so forth, and you come to the conclusion you do. If we had more time, we could say more about this, but if we don't have more time, we won't have a little time for questions. Yeah?
Well, because of our conclusion of the book, right? Why do you need four? We have Yehudi, Mashiach ben David, which is the spiritual, Mashiach ben Yosef, which is the pragmatic, which is the visible. Why do you need the following
set? Rav Kook leaves that out. Right. Rav Kook is really talking about dualism. If you're asking me what would Rav Kook do if he had to give the drasha and you held a gun to his head and you said, look, you know, let's turn the page in the Gemara and Sukkah from Amud Aleph to Amud Beit and now tell me about these four figures. If Rav Kook had heard the first half of my discussion today, then he would have a very different drasha. It would be an important drasha. It would raise questions, for example, about the relationship between the melech and the navi. What exactly is the role of the navi? I could very readily have given a lecture today, since people wanted to talk about redemption in some way, but I could have given a lecture on the relationship between Yeshaya and Chizkiyahu. It was Sylvia Rav Kook. Rav Kook wrote about that. The question of where the Kohen fits in. What does a Kohen do that is different from what other kinds of leadership would do? Why is it, for example, that the Halacha recommends that the king should not be a Kohen? In Hanukkah times, question comes up. What is the role of the Kohen that requires to be differentiated from that of the king? There was, by the way, around the same time Rav Kook was writing this, a few years earlier, Achad Ha'am, a secular Zionist writer, writes an article called Kohen V'Navi, where he sets up Kohen V'Navi as two opposing types. Now you're saying, well, if you really follow the Gemara, we shouldn't have two balls in the air, we should have four balls in the air. So you really force Achad Ha'am and Rav Kook to be juggling, to throw each other their balls and to start juggling everything. I would just say, look, a drasha with a typology of two is hard enough. So, you know, four gets a lot more complicated, and You know, but if you really want to do it properly, you really have to have all that plurality, and it will end up getting more complicated. You're right. Yeah.